Let's just get straight to our topic today. The title of our talk is called Spiritual Discovery, How You Can Better the World. And what a time to be talking about that here together. I just want to say that we're going to have this conversation with just all humility. This is just a time to share ideas, big ideas that I've seen be helpful to a lot of folks and that have been really helpful in my own life. I'm just going to be sharing stories with you along the way. And in a second, actually, I just want to start with a couple stories that I think you'll see are apropos for our time. We'll talk about the big picture concepts here too, after that, really explaining what is spiritual discovery? What does that even mean? What is healing? What is God? What is spirituality? What is prayer? These words that are really big to everybody that people are really thinking about, I think, right now. But we want to know what they mean as we use them. And then as we kind of talk through some of that and what healing is and how it happens, we'll talk about just some more of the kind of layers of things that I think are really on people's minds today and really show how these key concepts apply. So first, let me tell you a couple stories. The first one is of a big meeting I went to a while back, maybe 20 years back or so. And there were thousands of people at this meeting. It was a multi-day long conference, and it had gone really well. I think people were feeling really good about it. And then it came to the very last day, and the very last session was a panel discussion. So the people who'd organized the conference were up front. There was about a handful of them or so. And it was a Q&A time. So people were asking questions, and one of the questions that came up was, kind of a controversial question. And the issue to me was not a really important one on my radar at the time. It wasn't something that I had given a lot of thought to, or it certainly wasn't anything that I was passionate about. But what happened was, as the question was being asked and the first panelist up front tried to respond, it seemed to agitate people. The people who had asked the question didn't like the answer, felt maybe the real issue was being dodged. And they were getting upset. But what was more was it was like the whole audience was kind of getting sucked into this feeling of agitation. Well, the next person tried to answer, and then the next and the next, and it kind of went down the row. And every time there was an effort to kind of quell things or offer a genuine response, it just got worse. And if any of you have ever been at a sporting event before where people go around and do the wave, it was kind of like that, except in a negative sense. This huge audience of thousands of people, it just sort of swelled with anger, with irritation, with just a feeling of injustice. And I was included in that. Like I said, beforehand, I had not been passionate about this issue at all, but I felt myself just right along with everybody else get really caught up in a kind of mass hypnotism, almost just a mob mentality. I think I would not have wanted to be one of the people on the stage that day. I can only imagine looking out at this audience of thousands of really angry people, maybe looking like they were about to storm the stage. Well, there was one person left on the panel, and that person stood up to try and help. And I'll tell you, I've actually talked to that person since this time. I wouldn't say I've gotten to know her really well, but a little bit. She's a Christian Scientist. And she just started talking about love on a really deep and broad, inclusive kind of a level. She wasn't even taking the question as it was on the surface head on. I think she was addressing that mentality that had just swelled up, ballooned up in the room. And something happened as she talked about love, and maybe it was more than what she said. It was how she was acting. And even more than that, it was probably just deeply about what she was thinking and seeing. And we'll talk more about that. But it was kind of like someone took a pin and just popped this balloon, not in like a violent kind of a way, but in a way that just all of the anger and fear and irritation just started to just sort of sleep out of the room quickly. So quick that it was dramatic for me, having not realized the way I'd been caught up in the swell originally, until it was gone, until the feeling in the room deflated. And suddenly it was kind of like waking up and going, wow, what happened? How did I get caught up in that? And then just love seemed to fill the room. And the question was answered, I guess, as it needed to be at the time. And the meeting went forward. So I want to tie that into the next story. And then again, like I said, tell you a little bit about our big ideas for today. And then we'll circle back and kind of unpack all that. What does it mean? What are the implications of that in regard to what we're talking about today? So the next story is of a time when I received a phone call in my role as a Christian Science practitioner. And it was from a mother of a young family. They were on a road trip together. They were driving across country, and they had stopped about halfway across the country to visit a family member. It was just meant to be a brief visit. It was part of their drive. And so they hadn't planned on staying anywhere else. There was no other kind of hotel room booked. And the reason that's important is because they found out either right before they got there or when they got there that the family that they'd been planning to stay with had been sick. They'd all come down with the flu. They stayed there anyway and spent time with the family. It was just meant to be, like I said, a very short visit. They were going to be there for the day and then leave, I guess, the next day. So they got there, spent the day together, maybe they spent that night and then left the next day. And so, but within that day or so, the family, by the end of the time they were hanging out and all getting ready to go to bed, she said every single member of their family started to come down with these same symptoms that the other family members had had. And so she was really worried. She said, you know, we all got to get in this van together tomorrow. There's three little kids and the mom and the dad. Can you pray with us? It's not a good time for us to be dealing with this. And so I said we would. And again, we're going to talk about prayer here in just a moment. But the short of it is that we did pray together that night. And we grounded that prayer in the idea that the good that this family, both families, was receiving came straight from God, not from the environment around them in a physical sense, but from the nature of God, which was all around them, and actually the defining power in their lives. In the morning, they woke up and got in the van and started driving, and she called me and she said, you know, it's really incredible. I've never felt anything like it, but this morning every single one of us is feeling perfect, including the three kids. And she was just so grateful for that. It felt natural, but it also felt wonderful. So now let's just talk about prayer for a minute. Let's talk about what that is and how it works. To do that, let's look at what Jesus said about prayer. In the Bible, Jesus was asked by people around him, how do you pray? And his the first part of his response was, go into your closet. I'm sure there's lots of ways to look at that. One thing Jesus was trying to address in that moment was, don't let your prayer be about external stuff. Don't let it be about your outward actions and trying to impress other people around you. This is about your time with God. I think part of that you might say too is a little bit like get away from prayer being about these external things. Step back even within yourself mentally. Step back from fear. Step back from preconceived notions about things. Step back from the surface appearance of things. Step back from the opinions of others. So step back for a second. And then what Jesus says after he tells them to go into their closet is he gives what many Christians today call the Lord's Prayer. We won't talk all about the whole Lord's Prayer. Some folks call it the Our Father. But in essence, this prayer talks about the nature of God, and it talks about our relationship with God, and it talks about what that means in our lives. It's not a long prayer, but if you look at this whole kind of conversation in a broad brushstroke kind of a way, it's like when Jesus is asked how to pray, he's saying, step back from the fear and the knee-jerk reactions and the preconceived notions, get focused on the nature of God and on our relationship with God and what that means in our lives. Now, if we're to think about that for a second, get focused on the nature of God, if that's kind of the key element of the prayer, well, what is God? Well, God is an infinite subject, so there are many ways to think about the nature of God. One way Jesus talked about God is as spirit. Now, if you're like a lot of folks, spirit can sound like a pretty abstract word, including me. that word has sometimes felt really kind of ethereal or nebulous in some way. But if you really look at that word, it's the same word in both Greek and Hebrew. You know, the New Testament, the Bible is written in Greek, and the Hebrew scriptures are all written in Hebrew, what Christians call the Old Testament. And the word means wind or breath in Hebrew and in Greek. And so that just sort of brings it back down to our experience a little bit. The word spirit is not meant to be this kind of abstract thing. In fact, it has this wonderful implication of something that is always with us. When you think about the air, you know, the wind, it's ever present, right? There's not a place where we go where we're just not always in that. In fact, it's just so ingrained in a part of our lives that we don't even think about it most of the time. Like, you don't think about your breath most of the time until it's gone, maybe. If something like causes you to catch your breath, then you're aware, you know. If you jump into the pool, then you're aware of your breath. But apart from that, it's just always there. And it's really life itself. And so the implication of this God being spirit is something very different than you know, the kind of old man up in the clouds thing that you might see in a movie that likes some people or not other people, or sends good to some people or not other people, or whatever. God is not like this personality, you know, that loves and hates, but is this ever-present source that is life itself. It says elsewhere in the New Testament in the Bible that God is love itself. So love all around us, love as our very life. The Bible also says God is truth itself. So if you think about this way of the God that Jesus talked about God, it just makes it feel very, very present and very big, very relevant, as opposed to nebulous or abstract. In fact, the Bible says that nothing was made that God didn't make. Everything that was made was made by God, and nothing was made that God didn't make. And so you have this feeling of God being really truly the source of all that is real and all that is good. And it is always good, because the Bible also says that God is of pure eyes than to behold evil, that God is pure. So everything that God made is good. And that's ever present. So this, if the God is life and truth and love and this ever-present source, many faith traditions even think of God as omnipotent and omniscient. Well, it's all drawn from scripture. There are many references that talk about God as the source of all wisdom and intelligence and understanding and so forth. If that's what God is, and our prayer is about taking a step back from the surface appearance of things and getting focused on the nature of God and our relationship with God, that's the next key element. What is our relationship to a God that is ever-present, that is omniscient, love, that is life itself? What does that mean? Well, let's look at some of the things the Bible says about us and our relationship with God. Actually, this idea of our relationship with God is so close. It's mentioned on page 2 in the Bible. The Bible says we're made in the very likeness of God. And that theme runs throughout the Bible. Another passage that I really love from the Bible is from the book of Isaiah. And let me just read you a couple lines here, okay? This is from Isaiah 43. Isaiah writes, kind of like in the voice of God speaking, bring my sons from far away and my daughters from the end of the earth, everyone who's called by my name, whom I created for my glory, whom I formed and made. So sons from far away, daughters from the ends of the earth, that is inclusive of everybody. Called by God, formed by God, made by God, that sounds good if it's the kind of God we're talking about. And who heard the reason why, though? Did you hear it? The purpose? Why did God make us? It says, for God's glory, made for the glory of God. And this has something to do with, you know, if we are made in the very likeness of God, the word glory, to glorify something, means to make it known. Now, you could think of making God known as just kind of going out and talking about God. But this isn't, this passage isn't talking about what we do or say. It's talking about who we are. It's talking about our very being. And that relates to that idea that we are made in the likeness of God. To glorify something, again, it means to make it known, or to be the brightness or the brilliance of something, is the glory of something. And so we can think of ourselves as the brightness or the brilliance of God, the glory of God. We are made for the glory of God. You can't see truth, right? Anyone ever seen truth? Have you ever seen love? No. But you can see love expressed, right? You can see it in when it takes form. You can see love in acts of compassion and kindness. And so love is love, but then it needs a form. It needs to take shape. And so this is what I think the Bible is saying. We are where love takes shape. We are where the truth itself is made manifest, where life itself is made manifest. You, me, everybody, we're like sons and daughters from the ends of the earth, everyone, like love on legs. We are made for the glory of God. We are made for all this good that the nature of God is to be expressed, not in cookie cutter kind of a way, kind of ways, but each of us, because our source is infinite, in unique and individual ways. So made for the very glory of God. So coming back to prayer, and we're going to relate it back to these stories I told you in a minute. Jesus' broad brushstroke here, take a step back from fear and knee-jerk reactions, preconceived notions, get focused on the nature of God, on our relationship with God, and what that means about us. If we are made in the very likeness of God, it means we are made free. God is not inhibited by anything. There's not a power that's contrary to something that is omnipotent. Omnipotent literally means all power. So there's not two, there's just one. So if that omnipotence is made manifest in us, then it means our very being is free. It means that's what we're made to be. It means we're made strong. We're made balanced. We're made whole. We're made loved. We're made connected to one another because we are all part of this one source. It's like the sun and its sun rays. We all come from the same thing. We have a relationship with one another, a single kind of family with a single kind of parent or source. It means that everything, remember the Bible said everything that was made by God, and that all good comes from the source. It means that everything we need is built into this singular relationship that we have with our source. All that is good comes from God. It doesn't come from outward things. We think that sometimes. We think it comes from a relationship or a place where we live or how much money we have in the bank account or what kind of a job we've got. But I would say that what the Bible's showing us is that actually all those things, everything that is good, every quality or characteristic that we need in our lives, comes straight from God. And then that takes shape in things like a job or whatever, but it's not from the job. It doesn't come from these outward things. It comes from God. And we're going to explore that more in a little bit. I'm going to tell you a story about that. But our very purpose, you know, when we wake up in the morning, when we think about why we're here and what we do, we're here for the glory of God. We're not here just sort of trying to survive or get by. Nothing can change who we are and what we do. We're here for, to be the place where truth and life and love the intelligence of the universe is made manifest. Now, here's where we have to just connect the dots in a big way, because it doesn't always look like that. And it doesn't always feel like that. When you're looking at the sort of endless news alerts popping up on your phone, or listening to the radio, or even just the kind of internal dialogue that happens sometimes, you know, the kind of information that we're getting, the kind of thoughts that come to us are very different. It doesn't look like we're made for the glory of God. It doesn't look like that's all that's there. And here's where the key part of our theme comes in, that word discovery. We talked about the title of this talk is spiritual discovery, how you can better the world. People often think about spirituality as something that's very abstract, you know, or disconnected from daily life, as a form of just kind of positive thinking, you know. It's nice that you have your tradition that makes you feel good, but then there's real life. Or in kind of the worst case scenario, sometimes people think of spirituality as just sort of a way of people burying their heads in their sand, or a source of hypocrisy. And that's, you know, the word discovery helps us really look at all that in a better light. Think about discovery with me for a minute, okay? Discovery is what has progressed humanity throughout human history, right? I mean, we think about the kind of discoveries that have been made. Discovery implies that something was already there and somebody just, or a group of somebodies just began to understand it better so that they could do something with it or build something with it. The laws of aerodynamics were discovered, right? There was a number of people all working on that along with the Wright brothers at the same time. They were all working to discover how, you know, the laws of flight. None of them were just thinking positively about it though, you know? None of them just went up to a tall hill and kind of jumped off and thought positively about flying. There is an actual rule or law, something that was substantial, not visible, but a definite actual thing, right? That it was understandable. And it wasn't that the people, there was a fellow named Santos Dumont, who was a Brazilian guy living in France, working out the laws of aerodynamics right around the same time. They were the same laws, like to a T, right? The laws that govern the Wright brothers were the same that govern Santos Dumont. It's the same laws. And so it's not a personal thing. It's just these facts of the universe that maybe aren't realized or understood. We walk around not flying as long as we don't understand the laws of aerodynamics. But as these are perceived and we understand and build on that understanding, then we can accomplish something. And so that's just kind of an analogy for what it means to look beyond just the surface appearance of things, but not in just a positive thinking kind of a way, not in just a, I will think about whatever I like kind of a way. I have my truth, you have your truth, but what is the truth? What is it that is universal? What is the real cause of things? And we often have to take a step back from those surface appearances in order to discover that real cause. Throughout human history, that has been necessary. Discovery very often has flown in the face of the way things have appeared to be, the way people have thought about things, and overturned those kind of expectations. We didn't first see planes flying through the sky and then discover the laws of aerodynamics, right? It was a mental journey first. It was something that had to shift in thought, be better understood in thought, but it didn't just stay there in an abstract kind of a way. It had a tangible effect in the experience of all humanity. And so there is a connection, a kind of cause and effect relationship between discovering something that is real and true, an actual law or principle of the universe, and the effect that that can have on our lives, even when it flies in the face of how things appear to be. Here's another example for you. A little more, none of us, most of us aren't discovering laws of aerodynamics. So here's a more kind of everyday analogy. If I was in a classroom here with you right now and I had a blackboard behind me and we wrote 7 + 3 = 73 on the board, 7 + 3 = 73 on the board. You know that that's not true. You know that 7 and 3 equals what? 10, yes. But if someone doesn't know the laws of math, and all they know is that the plus sign, in a very surface kind of sense of things, means you put them together, right? So if you just look at that in a completely surface level way, 7 and 3 together equals 73, 7 and 3. No, but you can see the logic, right? You can see why if you only know the surface appearance, there's a certain logic to that. And that same kind of surface level logic is what a lot of what we experience on a daily basis boils down to. We talked first about what the Bible says the nature of God is, what life is, what the source of all that was made is, who we are and what we're really like, made in the likeness of God. People who have understood that throughout, you know, human history, we see in the Bible, which, you know, wasn't just written by one person, it was written by many people from many walks of life. When they understand something about the nature of God, you see them as they face difficult situations in times of famine, disease, war, something about what they discover about the nature of God has a tangible impact. They find health, they find a way to be safe, they find a way to eat and have what they need. They find community when they've been outcast from society. Again and again, we see this cause and effect relationship playing out in the stories we have in the Bible from all these folks, and they don't even have exactly the same sense of God sometimes. But whatever they're discovering that is true and universal, that is actually there, has this tangible impact on their lives. And so, you know, we talked about what God is and who we are, and then we kind of admitted that, yeah, look, it doesn't look like that a lot of times. And certainly that's not the narrative that we're getting, you know, through the news alerts all the time. Whether that's right now when things seem particularly heated up, or really at any time. And yet we have a kind of surface level 7 plus 3 equals 73 logic going on there. You know, we may be told, for example, that we have some, you know, predisposed character flaw or genetic problem because, you know, our parents had it or because we were raised a certain way or whatever it is. And that can seem to play out. There can be a kind of what looks on the surface like a cause and effect relationship there. If my parents were like this, I am like that. But that's sort of like 7 plus 3 equals 73. If I am exposed to someone who has a disease, I may get that disease. That's a 7 plus 3 equals 73 logic. It makes sense on a certain surface. We can work with that figure, but it's uncomfortable. It's not going to get us very far. 7 plus 3 equals 73. If you try and put that into practice when you do your grocery shopping or you know, working with your bank account, it's going to cause disruption. It's not going to be comfortable. It's not going to work out. And so even though there seems to be a surface level logic to it, the question is, what can we discover in the face of that logic? You know, that bad data, basically, right? The misimpression of how things really work. What can we discover beneath the surface of that, that is not just sort of my positive thought and your positive thought, but is actually true, universally true, timeless, about the nature of God and our relationship with God? And what does that do? What kind of an impact does that have? Well, let's look back at that family that I told you about that called me. They walked into the circumstance, and the surface level logic was, you are here in this environment where you are exposed to disease that is contagious. And you know, the general impression of that was, we have a certain level of susceptibility to it now. And then couple that with their own kind of fears and concerns about what they might experience, and which were not really rooted in who they really were, but in a surface impression of things. And then the logic seemed to play out, you know. Then they kind of wake up and, you know, are going to bed that night not feeling great. And so they call for prayer. They call for healing. how does that work? How do the dots connect here? What's going on when we pray? Well, again, if prayer is about taking a step back from that surface level logic, what are we doing there? Are we just, we're trying to ask this far off God to enter in and make these people better? No, because that's not what God is, and that's not what's real. What we're doing is waking up, in a sense, to what is already present. That's not necessarily what it feels like on the surface. It feels like you go from sick person to healthy person. But what was actually true and had always been true was what God made in them. They were made in the very likeness of God. Their very substance, their very being, the source of their life, their health, their wholeness, their strength, their freedom, their opportunity, their ability to be the glory of God, the place where all that is good is shining through, was always there. It was always there. And yet, if we tie this into our first story about this kind of group hypnotism, we can get swept up in it. We can get swept up if we're not realizing. And even if we don't really believe it in a way, I wasn't passionate about this issue, you know, but I got swept up in that thought. Well, whether it's due to our own little kind of fears about things or general impression about where health comes from or anything else, where jobs come from or where marriages come from. Those impressions we can just sort of be swept up in it at times without realizing it until something bursts the bubble. Well, what burst the bubble that day in the big meeting I was in? It was some sense of what was true. This woman, if you can imagine her standing there up on the stage, looking out at this audience, she could not have seen a room full of thousands of angry, hypnotized, like mob mentality type people. She must have, through the eyes of love, not just her affection for them, which I'm sure she had, but divine love, you know, the nature of God, looking out and seeing how does the nature of God inform my sense of who these people are, how they think, what they are. Through the eyes of love, she must have seen a wholeness and a goodness and a peacefulness and an ability to understand what is real and true right there. And what did that do? It's like somebody turned on the light and everybody who was in darkness just was able to see again, right? Light doesn't change what's actually in the room. Light doesn't change where the furniture is or the substance of it. It just reveals what's already true. To me, prayer, healing, that's what this is about. It's about discovering what is already true. It's about the kind of mass hypnotism or the individual little fears or concerns that distort our perception of who we really are, of what health really is, of what goodness really is, about anything that's good, you know, the opportunity in our lives or anything. And it wakes us up to what is already there. To me, that's what was going on with that family that day. They had been swept up into a certain mentality that, you know, was widely believed, just like it was widely believed we couldn't fly, you know, like before we understood the laws of flight in aerodynamics. It was widely believed that this is just the way things are and just the way things work. And then contrary to that false impression of things, came the light, came an understanding just that sort of dawned, just like it did on all of us in the audience that day at the meeting. It dawned for that family. Oh, we're well, we're whole. This is what we've always been made to be. This is, we don't have a substance that can be corrupted, that can be made sick. In one sense or another, even the little kids, it wasn't this kind of heady, abstract thing. It was just like an eyes open. Oh, this is natural. Right. And they were well. They didn't really, truly go from sick to well. They had always been what God had made them to be. And the misinformation that was causing them to literally feel, I mean, going back to the meeting, I literally felt all those feelings of anger and irritation, but they weren't mine. Right? They weren't natural to me. They weren't really even my real thinking. but they felt so, I was feeling every emotion of that. We can feel like all the emotion or even all the, you know, sensation of something, of sickness, until something wakes us and we go, oh yeah, that's not me. That's not what I'm like. The members of that family were woken up to who they are and to what was already going on. Neither I nor they created goodness in them. We just saw it better. Does that make sense? We discovered it. That's what I would call spiritual discovery. To me, healing's not a miracle. Again, not about a God that enters in and fixes bad things and makes them good. It's about the love of the universe, the truth of the universe that is always communicating with us, always caring for us, always giving us all we need. And that just dawning for us and becoming clearer. The word Christ to me relates to this idea of that truth that just meets us right where we are, the love of God that meets us right where we are and opens our eyes. Christ is the presence and the activity of God right here and right now, talking to us, loving us, shepherding us along. We see that power of God manifest in the life of Jesus in this unique way. He was called Jesus Christ because his life exemplified, right, was the greatest example the world has ever had of the presence and power of God that meets humanity right in just the way we need to understand. It was made manifest in the life of Jesus in the flesh, in a way that people could understand, in the way that humanity today can still learn from, right? Jesus taught us something so significant about grace. Grace, in a phrase we could say, is the unearned love of God. It's unearned because it's already done, because God has already given it to us, because God has already established it, right? The unearned love of God, it's a waking up to what is freely given. Jesus taught us something unique about salvation, which, big subject, but in very simple terms, we could say is that waking up that nothing can separate us from the love of God. That's salvation. At any point, salvation is going on all the time. That love of God meeting us right where we are when it doesn't feel like that's what's going on, and the light dawning for us in a way where we go, oh, and we start to see creation, life, existence more as it already is. Sometimes when things get particularly tough, when things are really kind of stirred up across our community like they are now, this is kind of a unique time. It's not easy, but what's good about it in a sense is that there are so many people who are asking questions right now. Now, wait a second. Where does my stability come from? If I can't count on all these things that, you know, maybe put on pause for a while or even stripped away, it may seem either temporarily or potentially for a long time. Where is my safety going to come from? Where is my happiness, my health going to come from? Where's my opportunity in life going to come from? Where's my supply going to come from? And it's a ripe time for us to look back as the kind of 7 + 3 = 73 information is stripped away. It's a great time for us to step back and go, no, wait a second, where's the 7 + 3 = 10 here? Where is the creation that God made? Jesus talked about the kingdom of heaven, and he said, you're not going to find it over here. You're not going to find it over there. People asked him, when is it coming? And he said, it's not a place. It's not a here or there. He said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. The kingdom of God is within you. That is, it's already established. It is here and now for us to perceive better, to wake up to. What Jesus preached was called the gospel. The word gospel means the good news. There's no better news than that it's already here. It's here and now for us to see and feel. This Christly action, this presence and activity of God in our lives, you know, when I say it meets us right where we are, it means it leads us to wise footsteps. Sometimes it just feels like a revelation that almost seems out of the blue when we experience healing in that way. But in many ways, it also leads us to just know right what to do at the right time, the right footsteps to take, to discover the kind of solutions, the new opportunities or whatever. If God is always giving it to us, then there's always a way for it to take form. But that's never going to lead to abstraction. It's never going to lead to a lack of responsibility. It's never going to lead to, one person doing something that isn't safe or right for their neighbor. It leads to unity. It leads to affection. It leads to what is good for everyone, not just for some or others. It doesn't lead to breaking the law, right? It leads to a harmony and that governs everybody in the right way. It's uncompartmentalized. You know, truth isn't truth for some people or just for certain aspects of life. The wholeness and the health and the goodness that is related to our well-being is related to every aspect of our lives. Mary Baker Eddy, who is the founder of this approach to prayer and Christianity, to this practice of Christianity and Christian healing. She's the founder of the movement, the Christian Science movement. What her whole discovery is based on is an idea that what Christ is, that presence and activity of God that we saw shining through the life of Jesus, is an ever-present thing. That it didn't leave when Jesus left. It didn't arrive when Jesus arrived. It has always been with us. And that there is a science of Christ. That means that, again, something that is scientific isn't just for some people and not other people. It's not for one time and not another time. Something that is scientific is timeless, universal, but it's also understandable. It means that we don't have to have a blind belief in anything. We don't have to do anything on blindness. It means that when we read what Jesus said, we can understand it. We can see how it applies to our lives. We don't do anything on blind faith, but as our perception changes, we know how to act in a way that is healthy and progressive for ourselves and for other people. This science of Christ is something that she felt. The more she understood it, it helped heal her from chronic illness she had faced from the time she was a little girl, from a severe accident that she experienced. Maybe even more than all that, it helped her break through the expectations of folks around her, of what women could do. She became the leader of a movement, a spiritual, movement. She wrote a lot, actually. She wrote a book called Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. I have that here, and I'll read you a line in just a minute. This book, by the way, has helped a lot of people. The last 100 pages of this book are all stories of people who wrote in about healing they experienced in their life just by reading the book, oftentimes of things that have been diagnosed as incurable. So she wrote the book. She started the Christian Science Monitor, an international newspaper. She was 88 years old, by the way, when that happened. She started magazines where people can write in, a weekly and a monthly, where people could write in about the spiritual discoveries they're making, what they're learning from the Bible, and how they're applying it to their lives and getting results right here and right now. But all of this was happening at a time when women couldn't even vote. So here we're talking about the forms of mass hypnotism that we face. And some of it has to do with health. Some of it has to do with opportunity, freedom, on just so many different levels. So we look at these examples in human history, and Mary Baker Eddy is one of those great examples of people who found freedom from what people said, you can't find freedom from this chronic illness. This will define your life. And yet it was like, no, that's not what God is. That doesn't relate to how God made us. And then proving it, not just a blind faith or words while we wait it out and kind of cope with it, but proof, you know, wholeness and health. But proof too, again, in the mass hypnotism the world has faced in regard to oppressing certain groups or people. She proved in her own life that, you know, whether it's the stuff we hear about age making people either weak or vulnerable, as someone who's in her late 80s and starting an international newspaper, Can we say that age defined that? No, not for better or worse. It was her nature, right? Just as it is all of ours, made in the likeness of God, that defined what she could do, just as it defines what we can do and who we really are, what, you know, we have or don't have. Perceptions about women at the time did not define what she could do, because she knew she was defined by God. This way of approaching things, this way of really experiencing what Jesus talked about, is something I think Jesus expected. There are a number of lines in his words where we find in the Bible, one of them is that, you know, he said, whoever follows me will do the works that I do. It was never meant to be about, you know, palaces and kind of, you know, just outward trappings of worship, but it was about our lives right here and right now, quite practically. Are you experiencing it or are you not? If you're not, don't accept that. Go back, look again. When we talk about a science, like a math class, if you don't get the right answer to the equation, you don't just say, oh, I have to believe it blindly. And you don't just say, well, this doesn't work for me, or it's not true. You know there's a science behind it, and you go back and you just learn a little bit more, you know, until you get the right answer. So the implication here seems to be that, you know, learn from what I'm telling you. Let it transform the way you see yourself and the world around you until you begin to see the impact of that, the truth of that, the results from that. Let's see. So I want to read you one quote from this book, from Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, and a quote from the Bible, and then I'm going to tell you a couple other stories here. From Science and Health, Mary Baker Eddy writes, first she starts the book by saying the time for thinkers has come. And here she writes, the conceptions of mortal erring thought must give way to the ideal of all that is perfect and eternal. Through many generations, human beliefs will be attaining diviner conceptions. And the immortal and perfect model of God's creation will finally be seen as the only true conception of being. Then she goes on, she says, science, she's talking about the science of Christ, reveals the possibility of achieving all good and sets mortals at work to discover what God has already done. So again, this isn't about a personal power. It's not about who's got some special something. It's about what God has already done. It means, and even a child can perceive what is already there, right? There's no special kind of learning or hierarchy in any of that. It's freely given to us. It's grace. It's already there. And then I'm going to read you this quote from the Bible. This is from St. Paul in 1 Corinthians. He writes, now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part. Then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And if you don't mind, I'll read you the same passage from another translation. Now we see things imperfectly, like puzzling reflections in a mirror. But then we will see everything with perfect clarity. All that I know now is partial and incomplete. But then I will know everything completely, just as God now knows me completely. So it's about us knowing more as God already knows us, right? So let's just, I want to apply this a little bit more to some of the layers of things that I think, you know, we're all thinking about, our neighbors are thinking about. And first I want to bring it back to the idea of who we are. Just because I think we really got to connect the dots on this one. You know, the first thing the Bible tells us is that we're made in the very likeness of God. And then the next thing, right after that, about a page or so later, it gives us an allegory, a story that to explain how it is that it doesn't always feel that way. Many of you know it, probably. It's about these two characters called Adam and Eve who live in this garden of all good. Except for there's this tree in the middle called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And in the story, they go and they eat from the tree, and then the first thing they experience is shame, guilt, and then suffering. They feel kicked out of the garden of good, and now it feels natural and inevitable that they should struggle for their little piece of the pie, that they need to compete with each other to see who gets the limited amount of good that's around, and that pain and toil are a normal part of life. And so first we're told we're made in the likeness of God. And then to me, I think what the Bible is saying is, now when it doesn't feel like that, when it feels like there's a limited amount of good and good and evil is our nature, let's trace that back. Where's that coming from? Remember, the Bible said it's a tree of knowledge of good and evil. So it's pointing out that it's about our thinking. And remember what we said about discovery. Discovery is a mental thing first. It's a shift, a better understanding of what is real and true that has a tangible impact. We can build on it. Well, the reverse of that, you know, could seem to be true too. That is, if we get bad information and we act on that, that's that knowledge of good and evil. It's another way of looking at ourselves and others and the conclusions that leads us to. Something we're hearing a lot about today, I see, you know, news articles and things are, you know, like, who's to blame right now on many different levels, whether it's in our own communities or where a source of contagion, you know, could be, and sometimes it divides entire countries or neighbors. And again, that's not new either. You know, I mean, we've been dealing with a sense of division and extreme kind of polar ideals about things that separate people in many ways for a while. It's not a new thing. But to come back to the idea of who we really are, to discover that, you know, to not get swept up in that hypnotic kind of a way. And it can just feel, we just suddenly feel, you know, anxious or irritated or something. To deflate that with love, to deflate that with truth, is to come back to the place where we kind of go, oh, right. Every single person in existence, including you and me, and everyone you could ever read about in the news, even if the information you're told about those people sounds like the Adam and Eve story, a bunch of good and evil mixed in, beneath the surface of that, the only thing that has ever been true that is absolutely untouched by the 7 + 3 = 73 nonsense kind of surface level, like arguing back and forth, what is actually true, the whole of it, is what God made. It's us made in the very likeness of God. It means that there's an inherent innocence and purity and goodness in literally everybody. Literally everybody. It means that we're all part of this one whole, this one expression. There's God and God's manifestation. There's God and what God causes and is causing in everybody. And we can see that. It is possible. It is not ignorant. It is not blind to want to take a step back and do what it takes to begin to perceive that better. It's not just something we say, you know, you can't just say 7 + 3 = 10, but not really understand the math of it, you know, like, cause you just, it's not going to really stick with you when comes time to apply that. Is more than just empty affirmations. It is something that feels like a seeing. It feels like a knowing. It feels like a waking up. And we know it when we feel it. And oftentimes it starts first with our own sense of innocence and purity, because there's something about feeling that unearned love of God that completely defines who we are, free from all the other things that we have felt defines us in a good and evil kind of a way. There's something about experiencing that grace of God which helps us look around and say, this grace that I'm feeling is so good, but there's no way it couldn't apply to everybody else too. A love that is this big has to apply to absolutely everyone. It has to define our entire world. So when we look kind of the implications of who we are, you know, taking that step back again, that's something we can stick close to when it feels like there's a lot of things kind of knocking at the door for our attention to say, well, what about this and who did that? Wait a second. It's not that we want to ignore the issues that the world faces. Mary Baker Eddy, again, the founder of this approach, established this Christian Science Monitor because awareness is so important. Because if we don't know what people are thinking or what's going on, then we can't be healers. We can't help. Escapism is not okay. Navel gazing, have you heard that phrase before, is not okay. Not caring or just thinking, well, I have my beliefs, too bad for everybody else. That's not okay. That's not grace. That's not love that is reaching everybody right where we are. It's an active participation in where people are and what they're thinking, but it is an unwillingness to just accept things on the surface. And the deep hungering desire to see things more as we are seen in the world, in the words of Paul again, to know as we are already known. I told you I'd tell you one other story here. One of the big layers that I think we're all probably thinking about, and certainly our communities are, you know, where are things financially? What about the folks that are going to be out of work or don't have an income at this moment? And that may turn around really quickly, or it may take some time. And so I want to start just by actually telling you a little bit of my own story, and then we'll come back and apply some of these big ideas again. In the crash in 2008, I had, before I was doing full-time healing ministry work, I had worked in finance. And when I got out of school, I got into finance. I was doing quite well at it. But unlike all my other colleagues, I didn't go buy a new nice car or, you know, anything like that. I lived extremely modestly and I saved everything because I knew that down the road, I wanted to do the full-time ministry work. And I just wanted whatever I was earning at that time to be a blessing for me down the road. One of the things I did, which was not a smart move as it turned out, was buy a house as things were bubbling up a number of years before the crash. I put a lot into that. I also saved a lot of money. In 2006, I transitioned into the ministry work, but it was new for me. I didn't have a lot of income, and then the crash happened. Well, I had bought a house, but I wasn't living in it. I was taking everything I was earning to try and pay the mortgage down, and I had a renter, but then the renter moved out, and nobody would move in because everything was sort of frozen financially. Nobody wanted to make any moves. So I now had a mortgage on a property that I had no rent coming in to help pay for, and I didn't have any income of my own. Well, as things continued to tumble down in pricing, I thought I need to sell the house, but nobody would buy the house. And so the short of it is, everything that I'd put into that house was lost, and everything that I had saved was used in paying this mortgage because I had no other income until all of that was gone too. I lost everything. And I had never had a late payment on anything in my life. I never had a late credit card payment, nothing. I mean, I was a very, and I still am, a very financially responsible kind of a person. But despite all my best efforts, the situation, the sort of what felt like the perfect storm of the time seemed to be a tough moment. And I remember really praying through this at times, and it would seem like a solution would come to the surface at first. We got a buyer for the house finally, but then their financing fell through, or it's just crazy things seemed to happen. A squatter moved into the house and caused damage. And, you know, I mean, it was like, I kept praying, but then things would get better. But then something bad would happen again. And what I realized at some point was I had never really shifted my sense of where good comes from the outward sense of things. I'm not saying that that caused the problems. I'm just saying that it wasn't helping me find the real solution. I would pray, and then things like would get better, like the buyer would get financing, and I'd say, oh good, and I put my faith back in that, thinking that, oh, because I have a buyer with financing, now everything's going to be okay. That's where my safety is going to come from. In other words, I was going into a deeper sense of what's real, where good comes from, and then going right back to the surface appearance again. Oh good, now that the surface appearance looks good, I'm happy. I was only turning to a spiritual sense of things when the surface appearance looked bad, but good doesn't. What's real doesn't change, right? It's not that it comes and goes. We don't use God to make the surface appearance better. It's that the surface appearance is not it. It's just not. It doesn't determine anything. Whether remember the story, the good and evil, the knowledge of good and evil. Well, it wasn't just the knowledge of evil. It was good and evil. It was the story that there's a mixture. There are haves and have-nots. There's good times and bad times. There's ups and downs. You may feel that you're one of the people who's down. You may feel that you're one of the people who's up and safe right now. But if we're relying on only the surface level criteria to make us feel that way, we're missing what's real, whether we think we're one of the haves or one of the have-nots. So I was ping-ponging between feeling like a have and feeling like a have-not based on the surface appearance. And when it finally dawned on me, when I remember sitting back at one point and saying, I mean, this real step back moment for me in my prayer, what, God, is it? You know, what do I need to know here? And suddenly just feeling that love of God really turning on the light for me. And you know, it just took a kind of hungering on my part that I hadn't fully turned there yet. I was still trying to use God to make the surface better, but going wholeheartedly into, God, what do you see? What do you know? I started to realize, oh, I see where the disconnect is. I feel like my opportunity's on the line. I feel like my worthiness is on the line. I feel like my trustworthiness is on the line. And then I started realizing, well, where does that come from? You know, it comes from God. It's not gonna be based on how much I have in the bank account or what my credit score is or what happens with the house. It will always come from God alone, period. And so we can say the same thing for people today, whether it seems like they have the job that they had yesterday or the source of income or the place to live, whatever it is, you know, seems to be the surface thing coming or going, pro or con, whether we seem to be in that position or not, every single one of us has the same responsibility, which is to better perceive where real supply, real opportunity, real safety, real goodness in every case for every individual comes from. And it's not just mental gymnastics. It is a discovery. As we go to the Bible and we open up or we read something like Science and Health that helps us understand the Bible and apply that to our lives and just expand our sense of what this means for us today, the purpose of that is to have our eyes opened to actually be seeing, oh, here's what's really going on right now. And as I looked for that, as I really dived into that in my life, I started to feel the presence of all those qualities and characteristics that I thought were dependent on this outward stuff. I started to feel that they were straight from this source that was not variable. God doesn't come and go. God is not up and down. God is not moved in the slightest by the hypnotism of the moment. And as I felt that in that really reliable, tangible way, things changed. They got better again. It was a moment, a down moment, but when they got better, they stayed better. There was one final moment where it seemed like this tough thing happened. That's when the squatter moved into the house. Long story, but I don't need the details right now. And even that, because I had not transferred my faith in things back to that surface appearance, but was just rooted in what was real, it didn't move me that time. And a quick solution was found. And within a few months, everything was, the house was sold. There was no kind of foreclosure or anything. Any debt was paid off. I was back and completely stable. All the things that I had feared didn't touch me. And it certainly didn't look like that. It looked like a lot was on the line, and it looked almost inevitable at times that there was no way out. It wasn't that I then was able to transfer my source of good, my sense of what is good and where it comes from, back to the surface appearance. Oh, I really used God to get things right. What that moment did for me was it grounded me, as these kind of moments that shake us up can ground any of us more, in the sense of reality, you know, of the kingdom of heaven here and now. That's what this has always been about for every single one of us. That was what Jesus was preaching, here and now, the kingdom of God. Sometimes, I mean, we may wonder if our prayer makes a difference. But if we're really clear that this isn't about us, you know, it's not about, does my little thought go out in some magical way and affect the world? If we're clear that that's not what prayer is for, then we see that this is not about a personal power, And we don't have to wonder, does my prayer make a difference? Because my prayer is about seeing what God is universally doing. And what God is universally doing, obviously, not just makes a difference, but is the difference, is what's real. Whether we see fear in just one person or within a lot of people, or see hate or inequality or sickness, it, you know, 7 + 3 = 10 every time. If it's 7 trillion and 3 trillion, it equals 10 trillion. So the scale is irrelevant. The principle is exactly the same every single time. So what we're learning in our lives about dealing with the distraction, the feelings of fear, the kind of hypnotism, the sensation of being sick, but then overturning that and seeing how the light of what is true causes us to literally experience health and feel very free and very safe, helps us feel supplied and cared for, helps us really perceive the opportunity that's at hand. When we're doing that, it's the same principle that is true in our own lives is true on any scale. Does that make sense? What we're discovering about what is true for everybody. That's what our prayer does. Our prayer is recognizing the truth, not my truth or their truth or some people's truth, but the truth. And that's why our prayer makes a difference on any scale, whether it's in our lives or for our whole community. We can embrace our entire community in a sense of what is true because it is the principle, right, of the universe. It is truth itself that answers what is untrue on any scale. I want to read you, as I said, these last two lines here real quick. This is again from St. Paul in the Bible. He writes quite simply, see now is the accepted time. See now is the day of salvation. Well, again, if salvation is about recognizing that nothing can separate us from the love of God, then it's not for later. It's for right now. And we can have those salvation moments again and again, as many times as it takes, until we really perceive it in an ongoing way. And Mary Baker Eddy wrote this in Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. It is possible, yea, it is the duty and privilege of every child, man and woman, to follow in some degree the example of the Master by the demonstration of truth and life, of health and holiness. So it's built into us, not because we've earned it or read enough or thought enough good thoughts, but because of how God has made us to be, because of how God has made all of creation to be. And our lives are not compartmentalized. Every aspect of our lives is built in to that, is included in what God is. Thank you to everybody who supported this today. Thank you for participating. Really, really lovely to be here with you. And thank you above all for letting your light shine and for your prayers.